The Legendarium podcast is brought to you by
you. So please visit patreon.com/legendarium
to support the show. But for now,
welcome to the Legendarium.
I tried to soften it by calling it a prequel point so that we wouldn't beat the shit out of it for like 15 minutes.
You can just title this episode the dead horse pinata because we have been going for the candy that is not coming.
The King Killer's dead horse.
It was late evening again. The Legendarium podcast studio lay in silence, awaiting the night's insult, and it was an insult of three parts. The most obvious part was a shallow, age-based insult made by an old man's apparent mental infirmity. If there had been a thought, it would have made its way through his mind and out of his mouth and brushed the insult away like an ephemeral wisp of cloud. But no, of course, there was no thought, and so the insult remained. Inside the podcast studio, a pair of middle-class 30-something white men huddled on a couch. They fiddled with their mics in quiet persistence, avoiding valuable discussion of weighty topics. In doing this, they added a subtler, more insidious insult to the shallow, obvious one. The third insult was not an easy thing to notice. If you listened for a year, you might begin to feel it in the rough concrete floor underfoot and in the gray 2-inch foam taped to the ceiling. It was in the well-used mixing board from which dozens of wires sprang forth. It was in the high, slightly nasal cut of a voice not quite suitable for broadcast. And it was there, in the bearing of the man who sat there, speaking into a microphone that couldn't quite make him presentable. The man had true hipster hair, hipster as suspenders and a mustache in a Brooklyn coffee shop. His eyes were tired and sunken, and he spoke with the smooth certainty that came from knowing he couldn't say anything worse than he already had in the long weeks leading up to this. The studio was his, just as the third insult was his. This was appropriate, as it was the greatest insult of the three, wrapping the others inside itself. It was patient and prideful as a lion that's not that hungry, and it was presumptuous as an LA-based fashion blogger. It was the ambition-soaked hubris of a man who is waiting for people to stop listening.
Mission accomplished.
Ryan is not amused. Yes, anyway, welcome everybody to the Legendarium Podcast. I am Craig Hanks, your host. Thank you so much for joining us. Please support the show at patreon.com/legendarium. And please, please go to iTunes, leave a review, and tell your friends. Gentlemen, it's King Killer Chronicles Part 1 again.
Take 2.
Yeah, take 2 indeed.
Praise Talu.
So if any of you are joining us, 3 to 5 to 80 years in the future, you may not know this, but there was another King Killer Chronicle episode. Those who are currently subscribed saw this, but I didn't post it on Reddit. I didn't put it on Facebook. It will never go on our website. It will be lost to the ages.
You subscribe to the podcast.
Unless you're subscribed. I mean, if you can reach that far back in the RSS feed, you might be able to get it. That happened. And now here's the thing. I'm not sure it was that bad an episode. It just was not up to our standard.
Which is low. Something that we really, when you hit the bar that low.
Think about that for just a second.
Yeah, exactly. We are kind of redoing part one. So if you did listen to that episode and we retread a couple of things, I'm sorry about that. But who knows? We may not. I'm not sure exactly what we're going to talk about today. I haven't run it down with you guys.
They're the lucky few that will see the fact that we rarely, if ever, learn our lesson.
Exactly. What was I going to say? Oh, yeah. How much do I love our listeners? This is how much. I just wanted to give a quick shout out to King Killer Kvavoth on Reddit. He's got 2 Vs. That's how he differentiates himself, I guess. I assume it's a he.
Would that
I don't
be
really
the...
know.
Double V, double... Never mind. You don't speak Spanish.
I do not. Sorry. He kind of... after the last episode, he got on and helped me think through a little bit of what happened last episode. Big shout out to King Killer Kvavoth for that. And anyway, I just love our postmortems with our listeners. They're awesome. If you are not yet on Reddit, sign up for Reddit and go to... thelegendarium.reddit.com and join the conversation there. And yeah, you can help us understand why we suck and maybe help us not suck so much. Anyway, I think so. What we came up with was that every book series that we've read so far, there's been somebody on the panel who is like all in. So with me, it's all the Tolkien stuff. Ryan, you're all in on Star Wars and Cosmere stuff, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. So whatever it is, there's somebody who's like, oh, we got to read this book. This is so amazing. With this one, I don't want to paint the picture that none of us like it or that any of us even dislike it. That's not the case. It's just that we don't have anybody on the panel who is like, you know, signed up for all the Rothfuss fan sites and, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Or even like multiple rereaders. So like everybody on one episode or on one series or another has read it multiple times. I think we've all read A Name of the Wind, or at least three of us have read Name of the Wind mm-hmm. once, but
right.
But we haven't gone and all the way through and done the reread and like gotten into the fan fiction and right. theories and things like that, where previous podcasts we've had at least somebody that's done that level, like really dived in.
This is the closest right. thing to a neutral approach as we will get to a series, most likely, until like it's like a completely new thing for us.
Yeah, I think it's going to this is going to be the generally trending direction, because after this we'll get into Gentleman Bastard and maybe Red Rising. And I think there will be, as we keep going, there will be more and more of us who are reading things for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to be a little bit different dynamic until we, you know, until I convince you all to read like the Heritage of Shannara or something like that, like where we can, you know.
For about a half second, their listeners, just their ears perked up like Harry Potter.
Oh.
Yes, exactly. That's what I thought too.
Yeah, we probably should do Harry Potter, I guess.
We did an episode on Harry Potter in general right around his birthday, but we should do a dive
we haven't touched
each
the
episode, yeah.
The thing is...
Or on each book, yeah.
Okay. King of Tangents, doing his tangent thing. Here we go. There's a podcast. I don't even know if it's still running.
Somebody just scored bingo, by the way.
Yeah, exactly.
Already?
Hold on. I know words. There we go.
Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. And it's these two like divinity school students, I think, who read chapter by chapter, read Harry Potter as though it were a sacred text.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I don't particularly care for the approach. But anyway, in a world where that exists, I'm not that eager to jump into the Harry Potter fray. It's kind of a similar reason why we haven't done Song of Ice and Fire at this point. Because
we just don't want to get those fans. We really want to maintain
this is an exclusive club.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
We're that coffee shop on the corner that almost gets the coffee right.
And our fans love us anyway.
Well, so yeah, I'm going to breeze by that one. Anyway, we should get going on this episode, though. I want to start... Well, actually, no. Before I start in on the book itself, we've kind of danced around the edges of this, but we should tell people who we are and how much of this we have actually read. So I'm Craig. I have read Name of the Wind and Wise Man's Fear, but both of those were, I think it was like around the time Wise Man's Fear came out. And so I read both of them about a year apart and remember some things about it, very few.
Ryan. I mean, I'm
asking you to introduce yourself because I'm serious. Like, there will be a lot of people who have not heard our voices before, who are, you know, Kingkiller fans, but haven't heard any of the rest of it. And, you know, even for people who are seasoned listeners, honestly, we're all going to sound pretty similar, I think.
We are the homogenized 2% milk of podcasts when it comes to our vocal range.
Exactly.
So, I'm Ryan, and I have I finished both of them recently. Actually, just barely finished Wise Man's Fear.
Oh, did you really?
Mm-hmm.
Was that your first time through?
First time through Wise Man's Fear, second time through Name of the Wind.
And so are you rereading it with us, and this
yes.
is your third time through Name
yes.
of the Wind? Oh, interesting. So you're the closest we come, probably, to
probably.
An expert panelist. Oh, that's sad. okay, go ahead.
I'm Kyle, and I read Name of the Wind probably a year after... released, And that, I've only read that. I haven't read Wise Man's Fear because I didn't want to read any of the, any book series that wasn't finished after being an avid Wheel of Time fan and waiting for that forever. So I didn't continue on Wise Man's Fear. And so this is almost a fresh read for me because it was so long ago.
Yeah.
And I'm Ken, and I have not read any of Kingkiller Chronicles going into this. In fact, it was really when we started doing our, hey, listeners, what should we read next? And everybody was suggesting Kingkiller Chronicle. That's when I first went, what is this book that we speak of? You know, Patrick Rothfuss, I know he's an author. So I am going in, you know, fresh as a baby, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Real for those, fresh.
And with as much insight.
And with as much insight. Exactly. So
for those who don't know, Ken first came on the Legendarium on a Star Wars episode. And then we were like, yes. Hey, Ken, you should read Mistborn. And so we taught him how to read.
That was the first step.
And then he read Mistborn with us. And anyway.
And so as par for the course on most of these.
See Vin fly.
Exactly. Fly, Vin, fly. So as par for the course on most of these book series, I am going in fresh on pretty much all of them. And it's great because it opens my mind to a whole new world with you. Yeah, I did it.
Get out.
We can't afford that, the royalty rights for that. So.
Okay, so now that that's all established, let's go ahead and dive into something that we kind of skipped over, and that's the prologue. If you don't recall it, just listen to my intro. It's the same.
Yeah.
It's the same quality, I'm sure.
Verbatim.
Yeah. So anyway, it's the silence of, is it a silence of three parts is what it's called?
Yeah.
And it's about a page and a half.
Just
and
a page.
So this is, I think this is the point where a lot of people are going to get hooked. They go like, this is the best writing ever. This guy can really write. And I wanted to ask, what do we think of this idea? Is this, is there something you want to share with the class?
I'm sorry. I opened up my Kindle to go to that portion, and I got a page that literally,
Ryan's screen says die.
Yeah, the only word on the screen is die. My Kindle's kind of pissed right now.
Okay. Yeah, man, I hate you guys.
And another bingo.
So I want to know what you guys think of this prologue. Is the prose as good as promised? Does it hook you? What do you think of it? Kyle.
Go. Yes.
Okay. Yes. Ken, no. Go.
Does not hook me, but it doesn't send me running either. I the first time I read it, I went, man, this guy sure likes to hear himself talk. But that's basically what I thought. I thought, oh, this is fine writing from someone who thinks this is what an author should be like. Basically, I mean,
yeah, I'm 100% the opposite of that. As soon as I read this prologue, I was all in on this book. It sets such a tone of sadness and bleakness, and I was so impressed with the way that he was able to turn a phrase. I really liked that he was doubling down on, you know, there's the silence of three parts, but as he's describing things, he describes things in threes. I just thought it was so well done. I've read this prologue several times. Like I said, I've only actually read the book once, but I will go back continuously to this prologue when I'm trying to kind of open up my own creative juices while I'm at work trying to write something or whatever, trying to see how to put things together. This, for me, is probably one of the best single pages that I've read.
Nice.
Noted. Ryan, what do you think?
I really like this prologue quite a bit. What it did for me was it connected to the part that recalls the opening segments of the Wheel of Time books.
The
wind blowing of, things like that.
Yeah.
And I knew reading this that the author, I'm sitting here going, okay, I know that this man will be able to create a very deep and rich environment for me to come into because he's so good at describing this here. My one concern coming out of it was, is this what I'm going to be getting the whole
That's
book?
Exactly my thought too.
And then as soon as you move on to the next little bit, I realized, nope, we're okay. This is just him setting a tone for what you're about to go into, but that's not going to be your entire slog. And I appreciate that.
Yeah, if it were 100 pages of The Heart of Darkness or something like that, and it were this level of poetic prose, so to speak, then that would be one thing. It would be kind of exhausting still, but it would be manageable. But you're looking at this book going like, how many hundreds of pages? It's like 700 pages or 800 pages, right? And so the idea of maintaining this tone throughout is daunting. And I'm really glad that he doesn't. And so, you know, he kind of dips in and out, and I have my own thoughts about what that does to his book. But overall, like, I think I'm more along the lines of Kyle and Ryan, where it's like, this is, this is a masterclass in scene setting, right?
Yeah. Like I said, the thing that it does the most is what Ryan said. It just really sets the tone going forward.
Yeah.
And it would definitely be exhausting if that were the whole book.
But I want to say, in the contrarian's view, though, I don't think I'm terribly far off. I think I'm just looking at it from a different point of view. I just look at it from the cynic's point of view of, he clearly knows writing, and he knows this is what writing's supposed to look like, but it didn't touch me as much as
I don't buy that.
It didn't
at all.
Touch me as much as others. Stop. My mic keeps moving, but maybe that's why
it realizes you're wrong and it's trying to get away.
I'm distancing myself. But anyway, my point is I don't fault anybody for liking it, and I don't fault anybody for, you know, it resonating with them like that. That's great. It just didn't with me.
Here's what I would invite you to do. Is go to any creative writing course, you know, ask some professor for a bunch of examples from their class, or, you know, a bunch of aspiring authors, and ask them for their first pages of their books, and you will not find anything this good. You might find some people who read this and thought, oh man, that's a great way to start a book. I think I'll try something like that. And they do. And maybe they're even good at it, but
they're not going to be at that level, but that's fine.
It's sort of like saying, okay, forgive the sports analogy, all you non-sportsers out there, but it's like watching the Yankees play and you're like, this is amazing baseball. And then you go watch the Marlins play and you're like, oh, they're not that good. But then you go watch your rec league, you know, your local recreational league. And then you're like, oh no, the Marlins kick ass. Yeah, that sort of thing. Like, no, this guy is a pro, and this proves that he's a pro. And so, Ken, you're saying something like, oh, well, I mean, I guess this proves that he can write. Like, no.
No, I know what I'm saying.
It's more than that.
And, I know what I'm saying.
And this comes from somebody, like, I will have plenty of examples of places where I think he gets a bit overwrought in his prose later on. But, like, this portion, this prologue, not one of those places.
Didn't hit me, but I'm with you. There are plenty of places in this book that I'm like, wow, that's wordy. But yeah, this one didn't hit me. That's fine. It didn't have to.
I think the only place that I would pick a nit with this prologue is in the phrase cut flower sound. Like the last sentence is something about it was the cut flower sound of a man waiting to die.
Yeah.
And somebody, it was Damon Lee Turks on Reddit, said, like, what is a cut flower silence? And they tried to kind of go through what this might mean. And at a certain point, I'm like, no, that just doesn't make any sense. So sometimes it can feel like it's trying a little bit too hard. So I see what you're saying there, Ken. Like I say, I'm more along the lines of Kyle and Ryan on this one.
At the risk of letting this horse come back alive, I can understand that sometimes, just as a matter of taste, if someone comes in with this language at the top of a book that you're not really prepared for or whatever, it could be a turnoff. Like,
yeah.
I can see why someone would be like, I'm not sure I want to go through this because I don't want to have to, I'm not looking for a book that I have to deal with this right now. So,
go. Take your mic out.
Okay. Hello.
Oh, I see. It's kind of hooked
that's
in.
Why.
Yeah. So. Enjoy. Okay.
I've got it. Don't worry about it.
So anyway, do we want to keep talking about like different aspects of his prose throughout, or do we want to kind of come back to this as we go through talking about characters and story and whatnot. What would you guys prefer?
It's going to be a recurring element in every portion that we go through. So there's no point in like trying to delay and wait for the right time, because it is a heavy piece as to why this is considered to be good or it's not liked, is his prose and the examples inside of it. And whatever you want to call it, his poetic prose, you know, poetry or whatever.
Flowery prose. Poetry,
something like that.
Yeah, but I like poetry. That's pretty good.
This is my feelings about his writing style in regards to the prose and the poetry. It's beautiful. It is fantastic. It is annoying when it takes me out of the story section that I'm reading. I think it is an expert. He's an expert in writing it, but there are times when I'm sitting here just cruising along between Kvothe and Denna, or, you know, two characters, and he decides to go through and describe Denna or describe this other moment, and all of a sudden I'm going, oh, okay. Can we come back to the narrative here? And I recognize the skill and I recognize everything there, and it is beautifully done, except for the moments that I go, now I need to get my head back into the story.
Part of it for me, and I think that's a really good example to bring up with Denna, is remembering the frame of story that we're in. So the way that the whole story is structured is we have our frame story, and then we have the story that Kvothe is actually telling Chronicler. And so it's Kvothe's voice as we're getting a lot of that description. And something that I brought up, we talked a little bit on Reddit with Joff Wu, is to remember that Kvothe is part of this Adema Rue troupe. They are entertainers. Like, it is in his blood to be descriptive, to be use flowery language. And he's also, if we're thinking in terms of story, he's also infatuated with Denna. He's in love with her. So that particular example, I know that there are more, but that particular example makes sense to me, that if he's narrating this story and telling Chronicler about what's going on, and then he takes a little bit more time to describe more about Denna because he's personally connected to this person. I actually think that part of it, and maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm giving Rothfuss too much credit, but I think that part of that language is just the nature of Kvothe's character. And so he's just playing that up a little bit more. And so I feel like there's a next level to it. It's not just that Rothfuss is getting carried away with his own ability to describe things. It's part of the story to embellish that.
Yes and no. I think yes, that totally works.
Sure.
My guess is that this is how Rothfuss wants to write. This is
probably
his preferred mode. Mm-hmm. And so it's very convenient for him to create a character who wants to speak and tell a story this way.
Well, I don't think convenient. I think purposeful.
Well, maybe. Yeah. I mean,
so like, this is how I like to do it, but
I'm not saying convenient as a pejorative here.
Sure. I'm just saying if that's how he likes to write, at least he's thought it through and created a story structure.
He's worked to his strengths.
Yeah. He's worked to his strengths, but he's created, it's like we talked about in the Wheel of Time about how, hey, we need to have these characters come back together. So we're going to put in Taviren because that's part of the story and it works. And it's a structure that we keep coming back to. And this is something that I think, you know, he's taken the time to recognize, hey, this is how I like to write. This is how I want to describe things. And at least it makes sense in the story to have that come out, rather than if I were just writing an article and I'm doing that all the time and it gets super obnoxious.
I think he kind of addresses this a little bit, maybe in a very meta way, for lack of a better term. When Bast calls him out about describing Denna, and I'm using Denna because that's where
we should mention real quick that we're only talking up through chapter 35, the end
right.
of chapter 35.
Right, him getting so into the university.
We've met Denna, but we know she's going to be a bigger deal later on because
right.
we've kind of read through it. So anyway, just once again, letting people know.
Running along the idea of what Kyle has said with Kvothe being so infatuated with her that when he's telling this story, he may fall into his own description and being a showman and kind of getting lost inside those memories himself again. I think that's fantastic. And as long as it's intentional, that's good. But he does, at some point, you want to, at least for me, I want I want the signal that that's an intentional choice. And I think he kind of does it with Bast calling him out on his description of Denna, saying, I saw her. She had a crooked nose. Like, he calls it out and says, no, you're embellishing the story.
Idealizing her.
Yeah, you're doing this. And so we get to say, okay, so when one of the biggest questions I have about this series as a whole is, because we're hearing it from Kvothe's point of view and it's supposed to be the true story, we're still getting just one perspective on this. It could be
that, and that makes me, I am still not certain that Kvothe is a reliable narrator.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously he's not.
Well,
I'd say obviously.
I don't know that it's, I mean, I don't know that it's that obvious.
I'm not saying he's a straight liar, but
truth.
Unreliable would be.
Yeah. But one of the things I really liked is that Chronicler kind of calls him on it. On, if you have the hardback version, on page 45, he says something where he says, but you of all people should realize how thin the line is between the truth and a compelling lie. And I do feel like Rothfuss is putting in little things like Bast calling him out on that, Chronicler calling him out on this. He's putting in hints for us as the reader that, like, maybe don't believe everything this guy is saying. Like, don't take it for gospel. Mm-hmm. It might be over embellishing. It might flat out be false.
So do you guys, do you have any stories that you tell fairly often that, you know, like, yeah, I'm kind of embellishing this a little bit, but it makes for a much better story? So for me, it's the story of how I successfully snuck my high school girlfriend out of the house in the middle of the night. It's one of my favorite.
I love that story so much because I know that story is embellished.
Yeah.
And slightly tweaked because I was part of this side story to that. And I know you've forgotten it.
What? I don't remember. I don't remember any of that. So anyway, but
everybody's
it's
got
a great
one,
story. And I mean, it's certainly based in.
She was my girlfriend at the time.
Well, that's
that's
true. That's
and he snuck her out of his house.
Yeah, there's a whole. It was not at that time, but at a time. Yeah. Whatever.
I find you unreliable.
And the fact is, I'm still here doing a podcast years later. Obviously, it's not that big of an issue.
No. Anyway, but the point being,
yes,
like,
we all have those stories.
It's a true story. And it's, everything that I mention in the story does happen more or less, but I can't, you change the order of things or whatever and just make a better story out of it than the actual event, right? And so do you guys have anything like that?
I think everybody has stuff like that. I mean,
not that I recall it. An immediate call up like, oh, yes, here's my lying story.
Are you looking for examples?
Not necessarily. I mean, I don't necessarily want to take a break and everybody tell a story. But,
and it's not always necessarily embellishment to make things sound better. Sometimes it's little pieces that are I tell a very specific way to ensure that this information, that you don't need to know this part of the information because that's not it's not crucial to the story, or it might lead you down a path I don't want you to go down.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I will tell you, I will word it this way so that you understand what needs to be understood moving forward.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, anyway, let's move on and forward. Let's talk about some examples, because I know this is something that we meant to do last week, several people, I think, on Reddit asked us to do this, to pull out some examples of writing that we really, really love. Now, we've already done the prologue, but Ryan, you kind of talked about this a little bit, that it's not that way through the whole book. Mm-hmm. And he does move into just regular fantasy narrator mode with his writing. But then every once in a while, something really pops out and grabs your attention. Did you have any of those? And in your mind, like you said, if it really distracted you, maybe it was a bad thing. But did you have any that you can recall that really popped out that were either bad or good?
Really strong examples. I don't have any marked offhand. But I can tell you that it's usually at the introduction of a character, and I appreciate Kyle bringing it up. It is when Kvothe gets into himself talking, describing music, describing his lute, describing, like, that's coming a little bit, I mean, his father's lute and things like that. But It's those moments that when we start circling back around, I'm like, okay, I'm kind of lost. I don't have one to pull for you. But any moment where Kvothe is talking about Denna, his loot, his plans to go to the university, things like that. And that's going forward, including going forward. Those are moments that there's probably like a very high chance, flip a coin, and it's, you know, you'll have a chance to have him get immersed inside of this circle of description.
Yeah. Kyle, you look like you're about to say one. I've got one, but did you?
Yeah, I've got a couple. I really like it when his dialogue switches into verse, and it does it pretty seamlessly a lot of times. And you don't really notice it as much if you're reading it on page, but if you're listening to the audiobook, you catch it a little bit more.
Read by Nick Podell. Wonderful yeah. work, sir.
So one that's super kind of generic, where you wouldn't think it would happen. He makes something kind of mundane into a rhyme scheme, and Coat is asking
you're gonna take mine.
Chronicler if he wants a drink.
Oh, you're not? Okay.
And so he asks, he says, I have it all right here. Old wine, smooth and pale, honey mead, dark ale, sweet fruit liquor, plum, cherry, green apple, blackberry. And that's just his dialogue asking him what kind of drinks he wants. But if you read it in verse, it's really cool. Like, oh, he took the time to put that together. Normally,
it sounds like it's like a guy who's owned an inn for years and years
yeah.
and has said the same thing over mm-hmm. and over and over again.
But who also has
a history of being
a musician right. and a theater guy. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So he does that quite a bit with his dialogue. And like I said, it's harder to notice if you're reading on the page, but I appreciate the effort it takes to make something simple
yeah.
into something a little bit more poetic or beautiful.
Ken?
I liked the simple one when he just is starting to tell the story and it says, Kvothe's eyes became as hard as flint, as sharp as broken glass. That said, do not presume to change a word of what I say. If I seem to wander, if I seem to stray, remember that true stories seldom take the straightest way. And I'm like, I like that. That's
it's kind of the same. Yeah, same idea.
It's the same mm-hmm. idea as, you know, he just yeah. slips into this, you know, rhyming musical mm-hmm. Dialogue that he has. And I liked that line simply because, what you know, it speaks for life as well. You know,
what it
the straightest path is boring.
Yeah. And I am the furthest thing in the world from a rap connoisseur, but the greatest, the best rappers and the people who out there who are writing the best things are those who are able to take simple things, simple lines like that, and not only just make them rhyme at the end, but match cadence, match emphasis yeah. and things like that and piece it together. And it takes time.
Mm-hmm.
And this might be a little bit of an apologist approach to why book three takes so long, you know, to write. Cause it took him 14 years or whatever to write Name of the Wind, something like that. Like if you take the time to write this well in these little things, like that does take time. I was watching an interview a little while ago of Lin-Manuel Miranda. He would write a couplet for the for Hamilton. And though each couplet would take like a week of just reworking rhyme schemes and things to connect it to different levels on that piece. And so to see that in the writing here and to hear it in the audiobook especially, which I appreciate the fact that the reader actually takes the time to get that to read it that way.
Mm-hmm. What it reminds me of too is I studied English in college, and Craig, I know you did as well. Had to read a lot of Shakespeare.
I did not.
Language though.
English language.
Yeah.
This is a bit of a bugaboo for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, but how many English courses did you have to take in that?
Like two.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Sweet. So it was not an English major.
Sorry.
No, well, it's okay. It's just a common misconception.
Getting a little hot under the collar here.
And he'll be able to tell you in three different ways where that came from.
Awesome. Whatever. Anyways, it reminds me of having to read a lot of Shakespeare because all of his plays are in that iambic pentameter. And all of these big monologues or whatever are coming out that way. And so when you hear the dialogue spoken in verse, that's what it kind of just triggers my brain.
It's different than reading it,
yep.
certainly.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Man. So I wanted to bring up maybe my favorite moment, maybe two things that I really, really enjoyed as far as his prose. But here's the thing is these are moments when he did almost the opposite of what you guys are talking about, when he pulled back from the poetic nature of what he was doing, and he wrote really, really solid prose. And this is what Ryan was talking about, where at no point do you stop to question the author, nor do you stop to applaud him. Sorry, that's a line from an essay that I love. But anyway, so there's a moment in chapter 19. He started to sing Tinker Tanner, a drinking song that is older than God. After a second, his son joined in, and their rough voices made a simple harmony that set something inside me aching as I remembered other wagons, different songs, a half-forgotten home. Like, that is solid prose right mm-hmm. there. I'll give you another example. Haliak spread his arms, and the shadow surrounding him bloomed like a flower unfolding. Then each of the others turned with a studied ease and took a step toward Haliak into the shadow surrounding him. But as their feet came down, they slowed, and gently, as if they were made of sand with wind blowing across them, they faded away. Only Cinder looked back, a hint of anger in his nightmare eyes. Then they were gone. So this is, it's simple and it's straightforward, but it is still really evocative. But at no point do you stop and go, oh my gosh, that was amazing. Like, I had to really, I was hunting for things like this as I was going through to try to find them, things that I thought were, you know, perfect prose. And right. this is really good stuff.
This is the kind of prose that I did enjoy in this book as well. That's why this is different than the prologue, which didn't get me. This is the kind of prose that I do enjoy, especially that chapter where he comes back and the blue flame and the Chandrian are there. And Rothfuss, he doesn't go overboard with the prose. He doesn't try to prose you to death, basically. It's just good, mysterious. Now you're in the moment writing, and yeah, it sucks you right in, and you don't realize, anyway, you don't realize that the author is writing. You're just kind of in the story, I guess, is basically.
People wonder why we make fun of Ken for finding words. But yeah. there it is. Okay, so, you know, Ryan, you're talking about beating a dead horse, but I'm pretty sure the horse is actually a tauntaun, and we've just been camping out inside of it for the last half hour. So maybe we should move on from the prose for just a moment. You know, years from now, non-existent bonus episode, Ryan, you talked about that you really liked a lot of the conversations that he has with Ben leading up to it. And I wanted to ask you about that, if you have anything off the top of your head from those conversations that you'd wanted to talk about. And I know this is a really specific question to kind of spring on you. And so we can come back to this if you want.
Well, I will give you, here's the general overview of it. If you're looking for specific moments or things that I can pull out, the only one that comes to mind off the top of my head is Roth was trying to introduce us to the concept of sympathy through Ben teaching Kvothe the basic concept about, you know, well, do you believe in your parents? Do you believe, and kind of getting him to this concept of being able to split his mind and teaching him the basics of what he's going to have to do when he goes to the university, because Ben can see this kid is heading to become an Arcanist. Like, if I have anything to do about it, he's going here. But Ben is the literally the Obi-Wan Kenobi, that he's the Gandalf, he's this, but not in the sense of being this all-powerful magic wizard who's going to solve all the problems or whatever. He's just a great mentor who happens to have this semi-scientific / magical skill set. And I've always loved in stories when they're done well, the mentor and student relationships. Because those are usually some of the most deep. I will admit that this one I liked partially because I didn't have to go through a whole lot of the win over the mentor to teach me that.
It just kind of happened.
Yeah, he sees the kid's got potential and goes, I got to teach this kid. He's got potential. I've got to do something here. Versus the teach me, please, you know, that we'll get later when we go to the university.
Right.
But I don't know. I am also grateful that he has left, but he is not gone in the sense that Ben could come back into the picture.
Yeah, I noted that too. And by the eternal laws of all fiction, I declare that he will come back.
And I'm a little bit, we talked a bit about this before, I'm a little bit surprised that when Kvothe ends up on his own, that more of an effort isn't made to go find what would be and is described at certain points as family for him. I know that he's in shock. I know that that's what the Rothfuss wrote Kvothe as not thinking straight, and that's why he didn't do what the easy way would be. But I would think that there would be something at the core of a character that would have driven him to go to try and find Ben, because that would have been something versus ending up, you know, dockside in Tarbian. So,
yeah.
Okay. Well, very good. Do we want to keep talking about Ben's stuff and his beginnings in training as an Arcanist, or do you guys have other bullet points you want to bring up? Kyle, I'll kick it to you.
I don't have anything in particular about, you know, sympathy or anything that Ryan was talking about with Ben. I really, really like the story of Lanray.
Oh, and, nice.
And
yeah.
Haliax, yeah. Or Haliax, however you
I had
pronounce
a lot
that.
Of marks on that section.
Yeah, I found that whole story very fascinating. And when Kvothe was listening to, is it Scarpies? Is that his name? Scarpies?
Yeah,
telling sure. him the story. And he's like, whoa, if he's right, then they're the same dude. Like Lanray and Haliax are the same because of the way that the story unfolds. And I'm really interested to learn more about that. Especially if, you know, what is to be believed that he's part of the Chandrian, and obviously Kvothe's had his run-ins with the Chandrian, and the whole idea that his dad was gathering as much information about Lanray as he could, and that's kind of what sparked, or we're speculating, that's kind of what sparked the Chandrian to show up in the first place. That story is going to come back into play.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I really liked that whole thing, and I really loved the parallel with the Teilu story, like the chapter before. So you get the whole basically origin story of Teilu and how he's destroyed these six cities and left the seventh one untouched or whatever, and then you get the next story with Lanray, and Lanray after his wife dies kind of goes crazy and basically burns down six cities, and it's like, oh, there's this parallel here.
Yeah.
And really cool. The descriptions are, while not confirmed in the writing, there's enough of a description to connect the Lanray story to Teilu's story.
Mm-hmm.
There's a potential, like, because he talks about how the demon lord and whose name?
Incanus. Yeah.
Has that his face is all shadow. You can't see anything mm-hmm. there. And as Lanray becomes Haliax, like they talk about how he's the curse that's put on him is these shadows always being on him. Like, so it's
right.
it's connecting these two stories. It seems like based on timeline things that one comes after the other, but that's not necessarily the case. It's entirely possible that the Lanray becoming Haliax or becoming Incanus or whatever could be
mm-hmm.
a prior to Teilu coming and taking form and trying to get rid of Incanus.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't have a ton else to add. I was more interested in how he told the story, you know, and how he wrote these stories.
I think even that though, like you've got the Teilu story, you've got the Lanray story. This story, like the name of the wind and like what Rothfuss is doing is he's creating a story about storytelling. Which is really cool because you have a lot of these little stories within the story, and he's framed it from
within the story.
Yeah.
Within the story.
Yeah. And it's just really cool to see it unfold that I think I'll have to dig up the quote and when I can find it, but he says something about along the lines of every storyteller is a little bit different. So Chronicler and Kvothe are talking about, hey, we're going to sit down, you're going to write down my story as I say it. And Chronicler says, well, every storyteller is a little bit different. You know, they want to tell their story how it is, but they also demand a captive audience. And then Kvothe asks him like, well, how fast can you write? And he says, well, I usually just listen and then I'll write it down later. I have a nearly perfect memory. And he says something about like nearly perfect isn't perfect. Like, you need to write this down exactly the way that I say it. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's really cool because, like I said, he's kind of calling attention to there are different ways to tell a story, and he's you know, deploying different ways of storytelling within his own story.
That's also the one of the first moments when I say to myself, oh, okay, so our protagonist is kind of a dick.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, yeah, no,
he's super arrogant.
I think on the same page, yeah. when Chronicler starts to actually write down what he's saying, Kvothe says something like, let's just assume that I am the center of creation.
Right.
Like, exactly. I think that's pointing to the fact that, like, this guy has an ego. Like, he thinks basically that he's the center of creation, even if he's saying it kind of in jest.
Unless he's right.
Yeah, unless he's right.
Unless he is, like, Teilu reborn or something.
I'm not even saying Teilu reborn, but that's the one thing is, and I think it's intentional, that, you know, you come in and you get that feeling, oh, this guy's arrogant, he's egotistical, and then through the next sections that you read, it's reinforced. Yes, all those things are true. This, he is arrogant, he is egotistical, he is a lot of these things. But by this point, when he is Coat, the innkeeper, telling his story, you know, as a hidden Kvothe, it is entirely possible that he might be right about this, about that nearly perfect is not going to convey the story properly.
Sure.
And you have to get this right. And, you know, maybe, and I'm going to put a very, very strong third maybe on this, that's Patrick Rothfuss saying, when I, you know, as I write these things, it has to be perfect to my storytelling.
Like, to my standards.
To what in order for this story, as I envision it, to be told, it must be told perfect.
Like you're right. Saying that's Patrick Rothfuss saying?
In a way, I think every author will put themselves in a character a little bit,
yeah,
whether subconsciously or consciously. And I think this is a little bit more that, in some ways, I think not necessarily that he is Kvothe, but I think that is probably his closest perspective, if I were to take a guess, in terms of telling a story in the way he wants to do it. So I do think that that's his voice coming through Kvothe a little bit, saying, I am in this world, in my writing here, I am the center of creation, and the way I tell it is perfect, and it has to be that way.
Yeah.
I also wonder if that plays on, like, the bigger story with Lanrei and Teilu, and we don't know. Kvothe is an unreliable narrator. And is there deeper meaning? Like, does he have a part to play in that creation story? Is Rothfuss giving us a very subtle, this guy actually is part of these larger, like, world building stories? You know what I mean? We don't know. So,
or he may inject himself into them as he comes to face, because if we take that premise before of, Lanrei becoming Haliax, being the demon lord in Canis, whatever, if Kvothe, who is currently at odds with the Chandrian, and Haliax is the lead of the Chandrian, mm-hmm. like, he's now battling gods.
He becomes Teilu reborn.
He's essentially battling gods. Not necessarily that's where it's going. But I'm saying that's what he is up against here. I mean, in this section that we're reading, he's up against hunger and, you know, the being at the bottom of life and, you know, his rock bottom up to this point. Sure. But in the long run, if you kind of look at what has been told in this section and what has been set up for us to be aware of, like, he is on a path to be the Clash of the Titans, you know, demigod against god setup here. And I think that I'm very hesitant to say that he is, you know, he is Teilu reborn or anything like that, because mm-hmm. there was never anything implied about uncertain parentage.
Sure.
Right.
Which, that to me is usually you were found, you know, you were left by...
He had no father.
Yeah.
You were found on the steps of Dragonmount.
Which,
you
know? Yeah.
Which reminds me,
That can't remind you of anything good, so.
No, I want to read you a little, just a little snippet. Selitos?
Sure.
From the story, whatever, the king mm-hmm. of that one hidden city, something. His eyes unveiled, looked at his friend. He saw how Lanrei, nearly mad with grief, had sought the power to bring Lyra back to life again. Out of love for Lyra, Lanrei had sought knowledge where knowledge is better left alone and gained it at a terrible price. And all I could think was, ooh, is Rothfuss going to try to retell the prequels? Is he going to do the prequels right for us? Anyway, so that's what that reminded me of is this is a bit of an Anakin Skywalker story.
I can see that. And I can also see that being a little bit of where Kvothe is probably going to be going down this path too. And he's probably, because of his nature, going to be looking for information that he shouldn't be looking for. The difference will be in the moment of decision, whereas Lanrei goes and becomes Sith kill the younglings version, you know, and destroys the six cities, you know, will Kvothe learn it and make the decision to go the other way, you know, and go and tell the Jedi Council that he found the Sith Lord.
Boy, speaking of flogging dead horses.
Wow. It's interesting too, because I think Ben's aware of the gravity of the like the Lanrei story and what's going on, because he leaves him a note in the book the Rhetoric and Logic book.
Mm-hmm.
He leaves Kvothe a note, and it says, "Defend yourself well at the university. Make me proud. Remember your father's song. Be wary of folly." And his father's song is all about Lanrei and like the Chandrian and what's going on there. And so I feel like that's just a subtle, like, this is going to come back. Like, you need to be aware. You need to dig in at the university and figure out what, you know, what the Chandrian are, what they want, where they come from, all of Lanrei's, whatever, you know.
Well, and this, that actually brings up a thing that I wanted to talk about. So the Chandrian come and kill all of his family and his traveling troop because of his father's song,
mm-hmm.
right? But we also hear earlier a nursery rhyme about when the flame turns blue, whatever, mm-hmm. Turn and run away, Chandrian, Chandrian. There's a nursery rhyme that tells you about the Chandrian, right? But the Chandrian don't show up and kill the little kids every time they sing that nursery rhyme. But when his father sings a song, they all show up and die, like, or then kill everyone. And I want to read his song because it's very short. And I don't know what it is about this that triggers the Chandrian to come. It says, "Sit and listen all, for I will sing a story wrought and forgotten in a time old and gone, a story of a man, proud Lanrei, strong as the spring, steel of the sword he had at ready hand. Hear how he fought, fell, and rose again, then to fall again, under shadow falling then. Love felled him, love for native land, and love of his wife Lyra, at whose calling some say he rose through the doors of death, to speak her name as his first reborn breath." That's the song. The entirety of the song.
So,
which is basically the same story that Scarpy tells.
Compare that to what Scarpy says, and we don't know what happened to Scarpy because the church comes and takes him away.
Right.
But with that being all that is said, there's no real revelation about the Chandrian, but apparently something in there was enough to trigger their little...
Was it in that, or did Ben have some like private sessions working on the song with his dad?
They did. He had a conversation.
Because I'm wondering if he was just privy to more of the song than we are at this point.
So, but it's literally after that is sung that they show up.
Oh, that's a good point.
It's timing-wise. I mean, yes, it's possible they could have just been watching and then realizing it just coincidentally, but that seems like really... Or writing.
I'm going to want to dig into it to make sure, but because I'm totally just shooting from the hip here, but since names are so important in this series, like, it's a huge deal, I would be curious to see if Scarpy actually mentions Lyra's name, or if he just talks about, like, Lanrei's wife or Lanrei's love or whatever, and the fact that, and love of his life, Lyra...
No, in the story, Scarpy mentions her name, too.
Over and over.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, one of my least favorite passages is from that story. And I love that mm-hmm. whole Lanrei passage. But when there are three paragraphs that are all structured exactly the same, mm-hmm. and it's in the midst of silence, Lyra stood by Lanrei's body and spoke his name. Her voice was a commandment. Her voice was steel and stone. Her voice told him to live again, but Lanrei lay motionless and dead. And it's the same paragraph three times in a row, just with different words. And it just made me want to rip the page out and burn it. I hated it. Anyway, so yes, her name is mentioned a lot.
Cool.
Ken, what do you want to talk about? We got a few more minutes before we move on to final thoughts.
We really haven't talked about him being in Tarbeen. I don't know if we want to or not, but I don't know. I go back and forth between why was he here for 3 years, kind of like everybody else. Like, why didn't he try to get back to Ben? Why didn't he even try to get back to that? Well, he tried to get back to that little farmer and his son who got him to Tarbeen, but he couldn't get back to them. But why did he stay there for 3 years? He could have gone back to the forest and lived quite peacefully on his own for 3 years, but he didn't. I don't know any of that. But the 3 years, it's kind of like a holding pattern, right? I mean, he is basically 12 when his family dies, and he's got to get old enough to get to the university, and so this is where he is for 3 years. And
you know, I on the one hand, my thought on that is because the story needed him to.
Yeah, that's
because the story needed him to get a little bit older before he tried to go to the university. But on the other hand, I do think that there's something interesting, and I can't remember if I brought it up in last week's not episode or not.
I don't remember. There was one,
but
there was one that I thought too. But go.
Okay.
Yeah.
So mine is, you know, why Tarbeen? He says, "You're right, of course. Anywhere would have been better than Tarbeen."
Yeah.
He shrugged, facing the fire. "But we are all creatures of habit. It is far too easy to stay in the familiar ruts we dig for ourselves. Perhaps I even viewed it as fair." And I think this is a really common thing for a lot of us, where there are things that we know we should change, and even little things. I go to bed way too late, and it would not be a big deal for me to just go to bed at a reasonable hour. It's not like I'm doing anything important. I usually, you know, I'm watching TV or something. But it is a rut. It is a habit that I've gotten myself into. And so even though I know it's the wrong thing in the wrong place, and like I should have better habits, it's just hard to break from the familiar, right?
Right.
And so I think that's, you know, obviously it's a little different, you know, going to bed on time versus being a street rat in Tarbeen for 3 years. Like, those are not the same, but the principle remains, right? It is easier to, what am I trying to say? The familiar is more comfortable than the comfortable.
I got it. I like that. So even the uncomfortable familiar is more preferable to
right.
Yeah, to finding a way to make yourself more comfortable. I get that.
What were you going to say?
I think that the one part I took away from his entire time in Tarbeen was his time with Trappist, the priest who took care of the infirmed kids and the sick kids and all that. And I made this point last week, but it was kind of briefly in passing. But in all of this chaos and torment and everybody will step on you or beat you for begging and all of that, he finds the one person who actually will take him in, will show him a kind hand and a warm place to stay. And I think in the 3 years of being on your own and as a street rat, that is something that he needed to maybe maintain his sense of humanity. I mean, I realize that sounds kind of cliche, but that's kind of what I took from it, is that was the one bright spot in that 3 years of Tarbeen. And I like the story that Trappist told also. So,
yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, let's move on. Like I said, we're coming up on the end here. Last thing that you guys want to talk about, Kyle, why don't you start us off?
I mean, I don't have any, like, we've gone through most of my bullet points. I just mostly have other things that I thought were interesting as far as like the prose or the poetic, like songs and things. One of the things I thought was really cool was when, so Kvothe goes out and kills like 5 Skraeling, and then he comes back and he's basically like on death's door about to die, and Bast heals him. And there's a little lullaby song that he sings to him. And, I actually thought that that was some sort of, like incantation and not actually just like a lullaby. The way that the scene was laid out, the words of that poem, really, it was just really cool. So I don't have it
marked. Don't have it pulled up.
I'll see if I can grab it real quick and we can read it. But I just thought that was kind of cool because it's on surface level, it just looks like he wrapped, you know, he bandaged him up, he put him to bed, he like did whatever he could to help him, and then was just kind of like there trying to comfort his friend. But we know that Bast is,
he's a demon.
He's Quoth's apprentice. He's a demon, has some sort of magical ability, at least we assume. And it felt more like an incantation then. Oh, so Ken's pulled it up for me here. So it says, then he began to sing softly, the tune lilting and strange, almost a lullaby. How odd to watch a mortal kindle, then to dwindle day by day, knowing their bright souls are tinder, and the wind will have its way. Would I could my own fire lend, what does your flickering heart portend? And so it looks like, if you kind of break that down line by line, you know, how odd to watch a mortal kindle, then dwindle day by day. So it's basically talking about life and how it's really fleeting, and mortals don't last long, basically. Knowing their bright souls are tinder and the wind will have its way, they will die at some point. He's watching his friend die. And what would I could my own fire lend? We know that Bast is a demon or a fae and presumably immortal because he's referencing Quoth as immortal. Is he somehow lending some sort of his immortality to save his friend in this moment? Would I could my own fire lend? What does your flickering portend is how that ends. So that was kind of cool. I thought it might be more than what it seems on the surface.
All right.
Can I?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Bouncing off that. It's not something I thought of before, but then as you read it, that part about, and the wind will have its way, it made me think, well, is that why he's so hot to learn the name of the wind? Because the wind will have its way clearly mean he will die. So if you know the name of the wind, can you keep from dying? Is that,
I don't know, maybe. I mean, maybe something along those lines. We talked about it last week, how the wind in fantasy is always used as, or is frequently used as a representation of God.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there is that immortality and all powerfulness of that. So the wind could be representing something along those lines, maybe.
Yeah. Ryan, do you want to go last, or do you want to go next?
Let me go last.
Okay, good call, because I want to bring up another prequel point, and I figure that's a good one not to end on.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm doing triple duty on this. I'm reading through the hardback because I do like physical pages. I'm reading through the Kindle, and I'm listening to Nick Podell, depending on which, you know, what moment I'm in. But anyway, so I'm reading through the Kindle edition at, I forget which chapter 32. And I think he's still in Tarbian at this point. That's right. And he's leaving Tarbian, and he feels like he's being followed, and he can't figure out what this, he's like, you know, my neck is prickling and all this. Anyway, and so I get to the end of this section, and on the reason I'm telling you which edition I'm reading is because on Kindle, if you turn this feature on, it'll show you frequently underlined passages, right? Mm-hmm. And so I see one of these coming up, and I'm like, oh, okay, it'll be interesting to see what people are frequently underlining here. I was so used to being ignored, I almost ran from the first merchant who tried to sell me something. Once I knew what was bothering me, the greater part of my uneasiness left. And here we go. Fear tends to come from ignorance. Once I knew what the problem was, it was just a problem, nothing to fear. And I'm excited to get to this this very underlinable moment. And I read that and I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. And I say it's a prequel moment because it reminded me so much of fear leads to anger, anger leads to hate, hate leads to suffering. I don't do a good Yoda. But, you know,
no,
I
man,
remember
spot on.
Even when I was 13 and that movie came out, I remember hearing that little speech and I was like, what? What a load of horseshit. Like that is garbage philosophy, and it's the same thing here. Like it's being presented as this thing, like this is how you overcome fear, and it's like, no, this is cereal box philosophy, and if anybody tries to live by this, they're gonna ruin themselves. Like this is stupid. Anyway, I really hated that underlined moment. So, Ryan, you feel I feel like you want to take me on this, and
I don't know about take you on. I do want to think about it a little bit because it's poorly delivered. Like, going back to that prequel piece, it's very poorly delivered. The anger leads to hate, hate leads to something.
Right.
That. But the concept, the underlying concept, I don't think is poor in what Kvothe's saying, or in that, in the idea that when we are afraid, once you know what you're afraid of, once you kind of figure that out, how you react to that will determine the path you go down.
Yes.
Whether or not you are dominated by that fear, whether or not you face that fear, whether or not you change yourself in some way. Honestly, I mean, that the path of, if you are afraid of something and so you decide to destroy it, like, I'm afraid of, oh, there's a spider in the room, I must kill it. Like, that is, I hate this, I will must make it, you know,
must
I
make
must
it
destroy
die.
It. And then all the other little spider babies that are depending on this are now suffering.
Kill it.
Here's
kill
my
it
thing.
With fire.
Here's my thing about it. When, so he says, fear tends to come from ignorance. Once I knew what the problem was, it was just a problem, nothing to fear. This is presented as kind of an absolute, or maybe not an absolute, but very close to it. Fear tends to come from ignorance. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, yeah, sometimes it's just a little spider in the thing, and you know that, like, if you understood spiders and you knew that there were only this many species of poisonous spiders and this isn't one of them and there's nothing to fear and blah, blah, blah. But sometimes you open the cupboard and it's, you know, it's freaking Shelob and she's coming to get you, and, like, you know exactly what it is, and you, like, that should make you fear it even more. You know, like, I'm speaking not literally, but the same can be true in real life as well. Like, if you understand a problem, sometimes that should make you fear it even more.
Well, yes. I think that's, I can agree with that. Sort of.
No, yeah, it's because you can never agree, like, with anything I say.
No. Does it increase your...
It's all right. We're only at an hour five.
Oh, yeah. Great. We need to get into the definition of fear, you know, and that we'll end up doing like 15 minutes on that alone. Just the idea is that are you still afraid of it in the same way? Like, that initial fear that causes that fight or flight response or whatever, like, you can still be wary and be afraid of something without it being that petrifying, destructive fear, even though you know what it, like, you've learned what it is. You know enough to say, I should stay away from this, or when this adheres, it is wise of me to be gone. I think it's different. I agree with this concept that fear, that fear is mostly based on ignorance. And if you don't understand something and are afraid of it, that it affects the way you respond to it. But if you understand it and are still afraid,
grow a pair.
I'm terrified of scorpions.
If you look at the problem as an abstract instead of as something concrete like a spider or a scorpion, I mean, say I want to try out for a play. I would love to be on stage. Okay,
bingo.
You have to go.
Somebody just got bingo.
Whatever.
Oh,
I'm just using something, but I want to be on stage. You got to go try out. Great, I'm going to go try out until the day of tryout. I don't know what a tryout is. I don't want to do this. Never mind. Forget it. I changed my mind. Until you go through it, and now you've gone through it, and you know what it is, and you know it's not so scary, so you can go do it again.
But there's a difference between nerves and fear.
Too many Christmas. So,
but
here's
that's the
thing,
fear leading to ignorance.
When I brought this up, I tried to soften it by calling it a prequel point so that we wouldn't beat the shit out of it for like 15 minutes.
You can just title this episode The Dead Horse Pinata, because we have been going for the candy that is not coming.
The King Killer's dead horse.
So... Okay. Anyway, I will go to my final point.
Your final thought.
Instead of attacking yours. So I know that this is a main point in the story, but it is not a main point that we dwell on a lot of time, a lot of this, our narrative with.
Okay.
But it's the motivation of our character. So I think it's worth spending a little bit of time on the Chandrian themselves. In our one interaction with them, we've got their backstory, but the one interaction with them is all we have to study from in terms of, okay, who are these characters and why is it wise for Kvothe to want to take them on?
Obviously not wise.
And what is he going to have to do to be able to face them? Like, what's get an idea as to what the path of the hero is going to be here? Because quite frankly, I don't think that these bad guys are Lord Voldemort, that there's some prophecy that connects him that makes it possible.
Right.
He's going to have to come to a level of capability to face these people. And that's partially because when they show up, we have Cinder. We only really interact with Cinder and Haliax are the two that we deal with. And we've kind of already talked about Haliax being Lanrei and being the lead of the Chandrian, and the other Chandrian being the people from the story who stayed on the other side of the line. Okay. Haliax stops Cinder from tormenting Kvothe a little bit and teaches him a lesson by calling him Ferula. I think something he says Ferula or something like that. And he says, "Who knows the workings of your the inner workings of your name?" And torments this other Chandrian simply by knowing his name. I thought that was incredible. Like, that stood out to me a lot because it showed that there is a weakness to the Chandrian. They are subject to the naming principle that is already being thrown around, established here. And there's an opportunity for Kvothe there. So if you want to know why naming is important, why it would be valuable to get to that point, currently, based off this alone, Kvothe has seen that knowing their names, if you could actually learn their name, I don't know what else to call it.
their true names.
Yeah. If you could learn their true names, you would have power over the Chandrian themselves. And I'm wondering if that
is where he's got to go.
Is the direction he's got to go, and what his father was getting close to, which is why, I mean, they knew him as Lanrei, they knew him as Haliax, but starting to actually be able to piece together something like that to where they could understand that concept.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're just preventing anyone from learning what names they would need to be called.
Mm. I like it.
All right. Kyle, you look like you're about to say something important.
Yeah, I mean, along those lines,
with
Haliax, he has an interaction with Cinder and he says, "Who keeps you safe from the Emir, the Singers, the Sith or Scythe, I don't know, from all that would harm you in the world?" And so I think that is perfect with what Ryan's saying, is their whole goal is to keep these people, the Singers, from learning their true names and being able to actually combat them in any way.
Yeah. And I'm excited for the Emir, because right now they seem to me like, for lack of a better, because it's one of my favorite things, they seem like Knights Radiant, because Haliax looks to the sky and says, "They're coming," and they all leave, which I'm right now assuming, and which will bite me in the butt later, I'm sure, that means that the Emir are coming. They've been in one place too long. They've been spotted or whatever. And so he brings them all to him, says, "Come to me." They all have to go to him, and then they Death Eater their way out
like
of here.
Death Eaters, exactly.
isn't there a part in one of the stories about what's it? Talu. Talu touches them and they grow wings and they blah, blah, blah. So that's kind of where I assume that comes in. Holy crap. We've gone so long. It's
and
an
yet
hour
talked
12.
About so few things.
I know. And so that's the thing, is we've got at least five more Rothfuss episodes to go. I mean, there's a ton of stuff that we'll want to talk about, but there's plenty of room to do it in. I am so excited to talk about the fan reaction to Patrick Rothfuss right now. Like, I can't tell you how excited I am to get to that bit. But that's not today. So we'll have plenty of time to get to that sort of stuff later in future episodes. So anyway, I do want to thank everybody for listening in, and hope you enjoyed this. If we didn't talk about some events, you know, like we didn't talk much about Tarbian or Dena or whatever, we did talk a lot about those in episode 177. So if you can go find that, you just go find that and listen to it.
I think it's probably important to note, especially for newcomers, that generally we don't hit a lot of the plot, like point for point. We just start assuming that you're caught up to where we read and we want to dive into just kind of what we did this episode.
Yep, yep.
And we don't hit every plot point. So it's like, you didn't even talk about the story. Well, we That's generally don't do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Get on Reddit and signal, let us know what you want us to talk about. And then we'll ignore it, talk about what we want to anyway. But at least we'll be aware of what you want to talk about.
No, I do not. I
know.
100% do not ignore those. No. And they do often drive a good portion of our conversations. So it is important that you get at on thelegendarium.reddit.com and join that conversation there. So if you have made it this far, you must be buying what we're selling. So... we hope you'll stick with us through the rest of this and, you know, make your way through our backlog and hopefully enjoy that too. Well, some of our backlog. Don't listen to those Lord of the Rings episodes, honestly.
One day we'll redo that section.
We are going to redo those. Definitely. We're going to redo those. So anyway, but if you are enjoying these, I do hope that you'll go to patreon.com/legendarium and support the show. If it's as little as a buck an episode, that is going to help us a ton with the costs that we incur week in and week out producing this thing for you guys. So anyway, now that that's over, next week, I think we're reading, I want to say it's up through what chapter, 66?
36 or? Through 66.
Okay, yep. So 36 through 66. I don't know what happens at the end of 66, so I can't tell you event-wise what's going to happen there, but those are the chapter numbers. And... that is it for us. Thank you again for listening. We will see you guys in a week.